Welcome to The Defiant. I'm your host, Tegan Klein. Today, we're joined by Arjun Bhuptani, founder and CEO of Connext Labs. We get an in-depth look at Connext, an important component in the Web3 stack. In a world of many layer ones and layer twos, connecting the chains is so important, especially doing it in a secure way. We get into how they approach security. We dive into the nuance of Vitalik's post on bridging. We talk about rollups as a service, how Connext abstracts away the hassle from a user standpoint around interacting with multiple chains, their proposal for bridged assets that's getting a lot of attention, as well as their recent launch, and so much more. But first, Arjun tells us about what he's focused on at Connext.
So, you know, I'm one of the founders. I have historically kind of done a little bit of everything, just as is the case when you're a founder. But now my primary focus is shifting towards two things. It's like system architecture. So trying to understand like how should this network be structured, you know, at the highest level. And that I think that involves just like understanding a lot about the core technology. And it's like a bit like research oriented as well. And then evangelism. So talking, you know, trying to get people to understand what Connext is about and why it's an important thing. And not just about Connext itself, but also like more helping educate the space around, you know, the cross-chain problem, why it exists, like what the kind of key parts of it are that people need to understand and how we can all collectively try to improve and push the space forward.
Amazing. Awesome. And it feels like you guys have been around for eternity, at least in crypto terms, starting back in 2017. And you guys have been focused on scaling blockchains before that was a thing. Tell us a little bit about the history of Connext.
So yeah, we started in 2017. At the time, you know, I'd been in the space for about a year at that point. I'd been really interested in building infrastructure. I had always been really, I'd been kind of really bullish about Ethereum because I was very interested in this concept of like a global world computing platform that you can go and build public goods on top of. And I wanted to find a way to create more public goods that look like the internet that let you coordinate with people around the world that are not necessarily owned by governments or companies. And I think that that's just like a really, really important thing for humanity to progress from where we are today. Still really, really believe that. And so Connext was founded in 2017 with like a very simple mission. The mission was like, let's figure out how to make blockchains usable. So that way they can actually be used by normal everyday users. And I think in 2017, you know, we tried a bunch of early things to begin with. In the first few months of like our history, we tried doing some card payment stuff and some like wallet stuff. And pretty quickly, when we started talking to projects, we found that actually it's really like the core infrastructure was the thing that needed to be improved. And so in basically late 2017, early 2018, we ended up pivoting into layer two scalability. And we built one of the first layer twos on Ethereum, potentially the first kind of general purpose, sort of not like like applications, but very, very application specific layer two. It was a state channel network, largely focused on payments. We built it in partnership with a project called SpankChain, which is an adult payment platform, which is pretty awesome. It was actually the only project in the space that had any traction in like early 2018. And then, you know, we kind of opened that up and generalized that later in 2018, and started integrating with a bunch of other projects in the space. Unfortunately, payments as a market didn't really take off. In fact, it still hasn't really taken off in the way that we originally expected it to. The whole space started heading towards DeFi, and that was when, you know, a lot of our like partnered L2 researchers, so folks from like the Optimism team, or I guess Plasma Group at the time, which became Optimism, folks from Arbitrum, folks from Matic, which became Polygon, we sort of noticed that all of those teams that we were close with were heading towards building their own rollups. And that's when we realized we could just reappropriate the exact technology that we've been building and find and basically like make it work for sending tokens between chains as well. And that was when we made the switch over to like interop and bridging.
Amazing. And I want to get into the user experience in a moment. But before we do, I want to just zoom out a little bit and talk about your vision for Web3. Why are you excited about this space?
Yeah. So I started to touch on it a little bit earlier, but I think that we sort of, today we have two kind of major categories for how human beings coordinate with each other. We have corporations. So like for-profit companies that are usually sort of like, you know, very hierarchical, effectively like a monarchy, right? There's a CEO at the top that kind of controls everything, or governments. And I think that one of the big problems that exists today is that there's a power dynamic where like one of those two entities ends up, you sort of end up optimizing for like the benefit of one of those two types of entities without really thinking about what ends up happening to individual consumers. And the only like existing coordination mechanism that we really have today that is not a company and not a government that people use at scale around the world is the internet. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, obviously there's like bad things about the internet, but it's pretty amazing to see the ways in which the internet has benefited the world as well. And so my thesis for the space, my vision for the space is that I think that there needs to be more infrastructure that looks like the internet. We need to find ways for, especially in a world where people are traveling around the world more often, like the borders that we historically had are really breaking down. And like the, you know, we live in this world where like super large companies, are basically like, you know, almost many of the largest companies in the world are like bigger than the majority of the governments in the world, which is kind of crazy. And I think we sort of need a third option, a plan C for humanity that is a way for human beings to interact with each other and like do things that really should be fundamental human rights that are not necessarily controlled by any one organization or one government.
Yeah. And on that, this naturally leads me to think about censorship resistance and the importance of that, because these very powerful governments and companies likely aren't going to love that we are changing the power structures. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think like overall, you know, we sort of have yet to see what the space is going to look like when it reaches scale and like what the relationship will be with governments and countries. But the whole goal of crypto is like, the whole goal of this space is that by using this technology, by using blockchains, you can drop the cost of coordination low enough that people can interact with each other around the world. And the cost of like then other people coordinating to try to stop this thing becomes so immensely high that it's really not possible to stop it at that point, right? That was kind of the original thesis behind Bitcoin. And Bitcoin censorship was like, in order to really turn this thing off, you have to go into people's homes and actually turn off their computers. And that's just not going to happen, really. At enough scale, it will never happen. Now, of course, in practice, it's sort of an open question. Around like to what extent that's needed. I do think that right now we live in a pretty crypto summertimey time where, you know, the vast majority of governments and companies are very interested in crypto. If they're not like pro crypto, at the very least, they're like open to discussing it. And I think that's a really, really positive thing. I don't know if that's going to be the case everywhere. As you mentioned, there will not necessarily be not everyone is going to be very happy about this kind of a power shift. And that's, I think, the big reason why we have to, you know, we talk a lot in this space about like, okay, we need to figure out how to build protocols and systems that actually are resistant to nation state attackers, right? And that's not just a thing that we say. Like, I think like a lot of the time, you know, people say that and then they don't think about like, oh, well, we've built the centralized system and we don't, you know, we're working with the US government, so it's fine. But the reality is like, even today you have nation state attacks, you know, like North Korea is hacking everybody's protocols right now. They, you know, I think there was a tweet recently from, Taylor Mohan, who said that, I think, who calculated that like North Korea has stolen, I think, $2 million of crypto a day for this past year, on average, which is kind of insane. So this is a very legitimate, very real thing that's happening right now. And so we do have to figure out a way to like architect these systems in a way where we can make sure that they stand truly for the public benefit and not just for like the benefit of one small group of people.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, amazing. And then kind of zooming back into Connext, lately there's been a ton of talk around user experience, and we're really thinking as an industry how we make these protocols easier to use than Web 2. And so how does Connext think about that? What are you guys thinking in terms of improving the product experience, the user experience?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really good question. I think there's so much that goes into user experience, and there's a lot of really awesome work that's happening around it. I really like that it's really become a part of the narrative this cycle, with a lot of the stuff related to account abstraction and like gas abstraction and things like that. There's a couple of things that we're doing here that we think matter a lot. We're trying to push for this concept of chain abstraction, where, you know, as a user, you know, if you were a user using the internet in like the 1980s, the experience was absolutely terrible. You had to manually connect to another network and then figure out how to connect to that network. So manually connect from your network to another network and then go and like retrieve data from that other network and then like use, you know, like view it locally. And that was how the internet worked until the web was created, right? And it wasn't until the 1990s when HTTP first really became a thing and became popularized that the web, that like the internet went from being this like very small hobbyist thing that like was largely text-based to becoming, you know, the like website-driven internet that we live in today, where you go and request content. And I think that fundamental shift is basically existed because there is an abstraction. Like we have this, you know, it's the same kind of situation today where when you have a bunch of different networks and you have to like manually bridge your funds from one network to another, it's not too different from the way that you use the internet in like the 1980s. But eventually we built this like higher level abstraction, which is the web, where you don't have to think about the concept of going and connecting to your new network. You just go and browse to a site and the site actually does everything for you. I think we're in a similar position today for user experience in the space. I think a lot of the like, you know, account abstraction things are going to help here. But from my perspective, the thing that we're very, very interested in is how to get to the point where as a user, you never really need to know or care what chain you're on, because users don't care. They just want to use an app, right? When you're using YouTube today, you don't want to have to think about how Google works. Or how they store their data in their distributed database behind the scenes. You just want to use YouTube. And I think we're in a similar position where like we want to get to the point where, and this is something that we've been doing a lot of work around, to get to the point where as a user, you can just interact with an application and behind the scenes, Connext will figure out how to deliver your transaction, deliver your funds or whatever it is that you're doing across chains directly to the right like smart contracts, routing it through the, you know, through any like swaps or aggregators you need to go along the way. A lot of the kind of discussion around this concept lately has been centered around the term intents. And so, you know, we are now starting to talk about ourselves as a cross-domain intent protocol. This isn't really a new thing. It's something that like we haven't really changed our infrastructure in any way, and intents are not really necessarily a new concept either. But it's just that the space is coalescing around terminology for this that makes a lot of sense. It's just a way to think about this problem of like, as a user, you should just be able to, similar to this, to the web, you should just be able to express your preference. You should just be able to say, I want to go and surf this website. I want to click this link to get to another website. And in the background, you shouldn't be thinking about like, okay, when I click a link on Wikipedia and it takes me to an external page, that I'm disconnecting from my connection to this network in the internet and then connecting to this other network. That concept doesn't really need to exist. And so, yeah, that's been our primary focus. We really, really strongly believe that when this shift happens, when you're able to use an application and never really even need to know that you're interacting with a blockchain, that is when the space will truly, truly succeed.
Amazing. And just to make Connext very tangible to the listeners, can you talk a little bit about who's using Connext today and how can maybe an everyday person interact with Connext?
Yeah. So Connext is a developer-facing protocol, right? We're a language for blockchains to speak to each other. We're actually not even solving the entirety of the cross-chain problem. And that's one of the key things that's unique about us that I can speak to a little bit later. But because we're a developer-facing protocol, it's sometimes a little bit hard to conceptualize as like an end user, everyday user, like what does it actually mean? There's a bunch of different ways to use it though. So you can use projects that are built on top of Connext. One of the most obvious ones that I think people end up interacting with is the Connext Bridge, which is of course just a simple way to send tokens between chains. But really like, you know, Connext itself also then powers other systems, other applications that kind of sit on top of us. So that'll include liquidity aggregators like Jumper. It includes like other kinds of, you know, DeFi protocols that are building cross-chain lending and things like that. A good example of this in the past was Fuji Finance, though unfortunately they recently shut down. I think beyond that, for us, the big priority now is trying to figure out how to solve some of the more like critical, pertinent problems that are in the space around cross-chain that are a little bit more specific. And so one of the other places where users will end up interacting with Connext is that we are pushing for the adoption of a standard around token bridging. And we think that this is just a stepping stone to get to more sophisticated things. But you may end up interacting with Connext when you bridge a token without even really realizing it, because behind the scenes, that token bridge is actually just routed through Connext. And so, yeah, there's a number of different ways. Our goal is to eventually get to the point where the ideal outcome for Connext is everybody uses it without ever knowing that it exists. similar to how you use HTTP today. You know, you kind of use the web, but you never really need to know the details of the protocol.
Absolutely. And I think Vitalik has scared a lot of people around bridging. How do you think about that today? And any advice to the ecosystem who may be a little bit scared to bridge tokens across chains?
Yeah. So I think there's like nuance to Vitalik's post, which is unfortunately missed on Twitter, because I think Twitter is not great for nuance. I think one of the key things that Vitalik highlights is that we're still going to have many chains. Like, we're still going to have many rollups, specifically, at the very least, right? There might be many different settlement layers, many different L1s as well in the future, but at the very least, even in an Ethereum maximalist world, you still have many rollups. We need that to exist. That is Ethereum scalability roadmap, and there's no way to get out of that. And so we will still need a way to get between rollups. And like the way to do that, and this is the point that I kind of mentioned earlier, where we don't try to solve the entire, you know, bridging stack or the entire problem of cross-chain communication, because and a big part of that is that we Kinexus is specifically trying to optimize to be a system that is very like particularly designed for rollups. And the way that we do that is that there are already bridges that exist between rollups and Ethereum. And those bridges are fantastic. That's actually there's like the fundamental security assumption of rollup is that its rollup bridge is secure. And so for us, the way that Kinexus works is actually fairly simple. We act as like a layer two on top of the rollup bridges. So when you go and deposit funds into a rollup, it's usually pretty cheap and easy, but getting out usually takes time, and going L2 to L2 is extremely difficult. Kinexus acts as a way, it's an intent protocol, so it's a system that sits on top of the underlying rollup bridges. When a user sends tokens, and we call this bridging, but really bridging means a lot of different things. When a user sends tokens from one rollup to another, our system of what we call routers, or intent solvers in Uniswap X, or relayers in Across, our system of routers just fronts liquidity to the user on the target chain. It can also like execute a contract call or something like that on the target chain as well. And then later on, those routers get repaid by a message that goes through the actual underlying rollup bridges. So my perspective in this on this is that I think that, you know, bridging in general, like in the sense of going between individual chains, is a risky thing. It's extremely difficult to actually secure messages that go between totally individual chains. There are ways to make it better, but fundamentally, it's a challenge. However, bridging between Ethereum and other rollups already exists, and we use it all the time. We have to use it all the time. And what we do is just make that simple, cheap, and fast, and also general, able to do any kind of bridging other than just tokens.
Need funding for your blockchain idea? The Stellar Community Fund is funding projects with up to $100,000 in XLM per project to build on the Stellar network. To get started, head over to communityfund.stellar.org and make a submission.
Amazing. And to your point on the ETH maximalist view and there still being many chains, just for listeners, rollups as a service is a huge trend right now. There are multiple companies dedicated to doing just that. So just kind of double clicking on your point there. Can you explain to listeners where Kinexus falls in the Web3 stack?
I think a way to think about it, so like if you could kind of imagine Web3 as a new internet, right? And if you imagine Web3 as a new internet, you should sort of think of like a rollup, like an individual rollup, as sort of what like a server kind of looks like today, or server or some other kind of compute resource. And then the internet today is the thing that is basically like servers and other kinds of resources on the internet, and then the thing that connects them. And what connects them today is basically a stack of protocols. So like a kind of fixed language for how these individual servers, routers, other kinds of agents in the internet can communicate with one another. And Kinexus is one of those protocols. So the way that we fit into this space is that we are basically one of the core protocols that will make up the interchain stack. At the base layer of the interchain stack, there's going to be transport layer protocols. This will include things like, it includes a lot of different stuff, but it includes things like IBC, which is just a standard format for getting messages around in the Cosmos ecosystem. Above that, you have a security layer that's made up of like different things, like, for example, roll-up bridges act as a security mechanism, light clients and other kinds of technology that's like still fairly new and just starting to go to market now, act as another kind of security layer for like different chains to communicate with each other. And then lastly, on top of all of this, you have this kind of abstraction layer. So something that sits on top of all of it that removes the need for users to ever have to think about everything that's underneath. And that's where Connex fits in. So we see ourselves as a really critical part of solving this problem, but only a part of it. Like the problem itself is too big to really be solved by any single protocol.
Absolutely. Okay, amazing. That's super helpful. And then can you give us an overview of how the cross-chain solution works on like an architecture layer from an architecture standpoint and why it's secure?
Yeah. There's basically two parts that connects. There's the intent layer that I mentioned, and then there's the sediment. And this is the case with any sort of intent-based system, is that you'll always have an intent piece where there's some off-chain actors that are doing something on behalf of users. And then you have like a sediment piece of like how those off-chain actors actually like settle their funds and get paid back. In other intent systems like CowSwap, Uniswap X, Cross, even like more complex things that will eventually exist in the future, you'll find that they will all have the same kind of overarching structure. For Connex, the intent piece is quite simple. We have an off-chain network of, as I mentioned, routers. Those routers are just observing the network at any time, and they're like providing the service of calling a like some contract on the target chain on behalf of a user, if a user is willing to pay them for it. And then below that, you have a settlement layer. So how do the routers actually get repaid? How do you make sure that they're doing things correctly? The way that our settlement layer works is that we basically, as I mentioned, layer on top of the canonical bridges. This is mostly like roll-up bridges or other kinds of systems, like the Polygon POS bridge, which are just like really enshrined into the space and everybody already trusts them and they're considered to be the most secure options out there. What we do is when you say, let's say, for example, you're a user and you want to transfer, or you want to, you have like USDC on Arbitrum, and you want to swap it for staked ETH. And as it turns out, the best USDC to staked ETH swap price exists on Optimism. The way that Connex handles this is that you as a user sort of signal in an application, maybe it's like a cross-chain DEX or something like that, that you want to get staked ETH. That cross-chain DEX will route the transaction to Connex. Connex, takes in your USDC. Basically, as soon as the transfer in USDC to Connex is complete, Connex will then, like our routers, will then initiate front USDC on Optimism and call Uniswap or whatever DEX it is on Optimism that has the best pricing on your behalf. They'll swap into staked ETH and they'll just give it to the user. From the perspective of the user, it's, 20 seconds, 30 seconds or so, your transaction is done. And at that point, your commitment is kind of fulfilled. From your perspective as a user, you paid gas on Arbitrum, you sent your funds on Arbitrum, and you just happened to get staked ETH. And so from your perspective, you didn't even really notice that a cross-chain interaction actually even happened. Now in the background, of course, the router is at this point out of pocket. They've like paid USDC to the user to make the swap happen. And they need to be reimbursed through the protocol. So the way that this works is that there is a message that then gets sent. We do this in like large batches, obviously to cut down on costs and things like that. But there is a message that is sent from Arbitrum to Ethereum. It's relayed optimistically to Ethereum via the Arbitrum like rollup bridge. We wait a certain period of time on Ethereum, similar to any other rollup. And right now that's about 2 hours to basically see if anybody's like going to dispute the Arbitrum rollup. And if nobody initiates a dispute against the Arbitrum rollup, we at that point have like a very, very strong crypto economic guarantee, similar to any of the other rollups, that that state is correct, that batch is correct. And then that batch of transactions is then sent over to Optimism and used to repay the router. As a final note, like, why is this model secure? It's secure because for two reasons. As a user, you're not really ever trusting anybody, right? You're trusting that there's at least one person online that's going to like be economically incentivized to just like take money from you, and do a service on your behalf. which is a pretty safe guarantee. And then as a router, you're really just trusting the canonical bridges.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that deep dive. Super helpful. And then sometimes, you know, I think things that are live today versus the roadmap can get a little bit convoluted. So can you share a little bit about, you know, what's live today versus what's on the roadmap?
So everything I've said so far is live today, and it has been since January, which is awesome. Things that are on the roadmap. So, you know, one of the things that we've kind of identified is like, for any sort of intent-based system, including ours, the settlement piece is the thing that actually drives costs. In the past, we're using a settlement system that like requires a lot of liquidity on each chain, because we basically have like pools of liquidity on each chain that we're sending assets to and from. But we're working towards better settlement systems in the future. And so this is one of the things that's on the roadmap, is we're working towards a better model for how to simplify settlement in our system such that it really gives you like the provably optimal pricing for any kind of transaction across chains. And that's the case regardless of whether you're simply sending tokens or you're doing some other more complex DeFi interaction. A part of what kind of fits into this is the XERC20 piece that I mentioned, which I think we'll touch on in a little bit as well. And beyond that, other things that we're focused on are chains. So we really want to make Connext be an open protocol as much as possible. And I think the right way to do that is to get to the point where, similar to the internet itself, like if you today go and, you know, create a server on the internet, or you go to Amazon and you create a new server, and that server doesn't come connected to the internet, it's basically completely useless. It's very, very difficult to actually do anything with it. And there's really fundamentally very little point to having it in the first place. I think rollups are in a similar situation where, like, today rollups, when you create a new rollups have to go through an enormous amount of pain to go and work with like bridge providers to get connections into their rollup to make it, to kind of give a good enough experience that people are willing to actually use the system. I think the right solution to this is, at least from my perspective, is that similar to the internet, similar to how Amazon works today, when you get a server, you should just come connected to the internet. You shouldn't actually have to think about that. And the way to get there is for Connext to become a permissionless protocol. So that's one of the big things that we're really interested in, is we want to make it so that if you start a new rollup or a new chain, you just get Connext out of the box. You don't have to ask us. You don't have to talk to the Connext DAO. It should just work, and you should just be able to connect to the inner chain. It doesn't make sense that it should be gate kept by any organization. So those are kind of like the two big pieces that are on the roadmap for us for 2024.
Exciting. Okay, amazing. And then let's talk about the XERC20. So you recently put out a proposal for bridged assets. What's that solving for? And then what has been the reception?
Yeah. So I want to kind of preface this by saying, like, Connext's focus has always been on letting people do more sophisticated things than just bridging assets between chains. I think that bridging assets is the like least interesting application of cross-chain stuff and the least interesting uses of blockchains. But of course, it's like the most used thing, and it will be the most used thing for a while, because this is really the thing that has PMF in the space. That said, I think one of the big issues that exists with bridging assets is that we've sort of taken it from a DeFi lens. We've tried to look at bridging from the perspective of how you build DeFi applications. And I think that it can benefit from being looked at from the perspective of like, okay, this is more like a messaging protocol, and you could relay more arbitrary information between chains that's like more interesting than simply, you know, I've transferred a token. And so XERC20 tries to basically double down on two things. It recognizes that there's a big problem with bridging tokens today. And that big problem that exists today is that you need a ton of liquidity on every single chain for every single token that you support. Or you sort of like lock into one system like Layer 0 or Axar or whatever. Basically, you lock into like a messaging bridge that has its own proprietary token standard. And XERC20 sort of looks at that trade-off space and says, okay, there has to be a better third option here where you get the benefits of, I'm not locked into any approach. There's sort of like a neutral interface that anybody can use, but I also don't have to spend tons and tons of capital on liquidity on every single new chain that I add. That's one piece. And then the other piece that XERC20 looks at is, is the bridge security risk space. So of course, you know, as you mentioned earlier, taking the, you know, bridge security is like one of the big things that's been on the top of everyone's minds for the last couple of years. The other big thing that XERC-20 does is it defines a way to basically rate limit how tokens are moved across chains. So you can send tokens across chains with no liquidity. That means you could send them like one-to-one with really like the potentially the best possible pricing. But doing that is of course kind of risky, because if you're plugging into multiple bridges at the same time, then if any single one of those bridges gets hacked, you now face or even one of the underlying chains gets hacked, you now face this like systemic risk for a token. And so the second thing that XERC-20 does is it lets the token issuer, so the person that's deploying the token, define how many tokens they want to be allowed to be minted on any given chain or by any given bridge. Now, the goal of these two properties is we ideally want to get to a point where, if you're a token issuer, if you're deploying a token and you're a DAO, usually this is a DAO, or it could be centralized issuers like USDC or Circle for USDC. If you're a token issuer, the thing that XERC-20 gives you is it gives you flexibility. You can choose to work with any number of bridge providers. It gives you kind of control over your security. So you can choose what limits you want to set for each individual provider. So you can, you know, decide that some bridges you trust more than others, some chains you trust more than others. And lastly, it gives you kind of this seamless liquidity. So you don't have to then think about how am I bridging my tokens back to Ethereum to like refill liquidity pools there, or to get liquidity through like the roll up bridges to each other chain. So it solves this kind of like fragmentation issue that everybody's been talking about. Overall, we're seeing a lot of interest in it. We've had some really amazing conversations with token issuers all across the space. It's very clear that this is a salient problem for a lot of folks. And, you know, in general, no one really has a solution to it. We've even seen, for example, last week, Circle mentioned as part of their bridge USDC standard that they put out that they've been looking into XERC-20, and we've had some really positive conversations with them about it as well. We think that there's a space to bring, even if you don't take the exact standard, there's a space to bring semantics from that standard into a lot of other token implementations throughout the space.
Exciting. It's great to hear the traction there. And thanks for breaking that down. Amazing. And then can you talk to us a little bit about other companies or projects in a similar space and how they differ from Connext?
So there's I guess, two like major categories of types of organizations that we compete with. Now, I want to say compete with like sort of quotation marks, because in my view on this space at the moment is really that like it's so early and everybody's going to specialize into different niches that I don't even know if necessarily all of these projects are our competitors. And even if they are, many of them I talk to like on a very regular basis and I'm quite close friends with. But there's really two like overarching problems that we're sort of like competing with other people on. One is liquidity bridging. And there, I think some of the kind of biggest competitors would end up being things like Stargate and Across. And then there's like message bridging. On the liquidity side, Stargate is basically a liquidity bridge that's built on top of Layer 0. It uses a pool-based model. Stargate's model is unfortunately quite inefficient. Basically, the way that the system works is that they like have pools of liquidity on each chain, and then they like lock up some of the liquidity on one of the chains when you want to interact with it, and then you do the transaction, and then they unlock the liquidity. That leads to a somewhat fragmented liquidity environment, and it doesn't give like the best possible pricing. And I think it's also like very gas inefficient. I think it's working because, of course, like, you know, there's a lot of like interest in Layer 0 and in Stargate at the moment, and that's driving a lot of volume. But I think in terms of pricing, Stargate underperforms when you look at things like aggregators. Across is the other major competitor there that we're really, really interested in and like talking really closely to. And Across has a very similar model to us. They are also an intent-based bridge. The fundamental difference between Across and Connext is that Across uses a basically Across's settlement layer is slightly different than ours. So as I mentioned earlier, our settlement layer uses like a liquidity pool on each chain to settle back to our routers, whereas Across actually only uses a single liquidity pool on Ethereum. And they let their relayers, which is their equivalent of routers in our system, settle to any chain that they want, and then the liquidity pool on L1 repays them. Across this system actually looks quite similar to some of the settlement mechanics that we're personally looking interested in researching at the moment. So it'll remain to be seen, you know, what things look like in the future, but that's really like the primary difference at the moment. And then on the messaging side, there's a few major competitors that I think a lot of people are familiar with. So that includes things like Layer 0, Axelar, and then I guess Wormhole as well a little bit. Wormhole and Axelar are both effectively chains. They have their own kind of independent set of validators in between. Between any two chains that you're sending messages through, it goes through their chain. I think it's an absolutely a valid model that, you know, like we've known about and understood chains for a very long time. And I have a lot of respect for both of the teams. I think one of the challenges of that approach is that it's very, very useful for cases like when you're trying to bridge to an external ecosystem, like another L1, like, you know, chains in the Cosmos ecosystem, or to Filecoin, or to, you know, some other alternative L1. But I think for roll-up to roll-up bridging, it's somewhat somewhat unoptimized. And the reason for this is that the whole point of the roll-up, the whole goal behind roll-ups that we developed in the first place was that the roll-up's whole security model should rely on the underlying chain. And so if you introduce now this like third chain that sits between two rollups when you're interacting between them, you've now introduced a new security assumption that goes beyond Ethereum itself. And so for us, that's really like the big difference between us and things like Axelar and Wormhole and even Layer 0 is that we our whole model is very Ethereum centric and it's very kind of rollup centric. We don't want to solve every problem. We don't want to solve security. We don't want to solve transport. We only want to solve this like abstraction piece. So we're like canonical bridge maximalists. I would say the differences between us and Layer 0 are also quite similar, except Layer 0 is just a little bit different than things like Axelar Wormhole in that Layer 0 doesn't really ship its own sort of security mechanism internally. It lets users like plug in a security mechanism. So it's not like a chain or anything by itself. Now, of course, in practice, I'm not quite certain as to how many people are actually using security systems in Layer 0 in production at the moment. But that is sort of what their whole thesis is centered around.
Ether.fi is a non-custodial liquid staking protocol focused on providing the most secure path to maximizing rewards in the Ethereum staking ecosystem. Your ETH can be staked and then restaked to earn you the best rewards, all while maintaining composability for DeFi applications. Not your keys, not your coins.
Okay, amazing. Thank you. I want to talk a little bit about your recent launch. Tell us how that went from the inside.
You're talking about the next token launch. I think it went well. Unfortunately, there's really no great way to launch a token is one thing that I've learned the hard way over the course of not just our own token launch, but also just talking to a lot of other people about theirs. There's always things that go wrong. That said, it's really, really fantastic to see the token out there. You know, it's already being used in governance. We have an active DAO that has already passed a bunch of proposals. We've also been sort of working to solidify like a broader strategy around like how the DAO is moving forward through governance and things like that, which is really awesome. And then beyond that, I think one of the really exciting things about Next is that it's also one of the first, it's really the first like cross-chain airdrop. It's the first, it was the first real like XCRC20 token that was live and at scale. And it's the first instance of a token launch where the token was actually launched on really any chain that you wanted it to be on. And I think that this was something that went extremely well that like, I think a lot of people missed about the airdrop. So when, you know, users, if you were a user and you were claiming the airdrop, you actually had the choice you could choose which chain you wanted to claim the airdrop to. And the way that it worked under the hood is that the Next token is an XCRC20, which means that as I mentioned earlier, you really get the like best possible pricing, the best possible liquidity of it across chains. And that opens up all of these like far more sophisticated use cases for things that you could do across chain. So a cross chain airdrop is one of them, where as a user, the experience was you went to the airdrop UI, you just like, you know, connected your wallet to see how many tokens you could claim. And then when you hit claim, you could choose which chain you wanted to claim to. And basically after clicking claim, within a couple of minutes, you just received tokens to your wallet on that chain. There were no fees. There was, there's like really no gas. That was no gas costs associated with it because we gas abstracted everything. And you just ended up getting this like very, very seamless experience. From my perspective, I think that this is really how like a lot of the token launches will look in the future, in the longer term. It just makes sense. Like it's somewhat bizarre to require that a user has to like go to a specific chain to claim tokens. It should really just be, you should just go to where the user is. And I think beyond that, we've also seen that like that has opened up a lot of really interesting questions for folks. Like if you can do a cross-chain airdrop, you can now do a lot of really other very interesting things. So I think Tokensoft, for example, who ran the Connects airdrop, announced that they are now doing like XCRC20 based cross-chain airdrops as well, more generally. And then we've had a lot of other projects reach out, you know, sort of expressing interest in this model, and then seeing like, okay, what other kinds of cool things could you do? Things like cross-chain staking, things like cross-chain like yield, you know, other mechanisms to use an ERC20 that is like seamlessly bridgeable across chains when you're also packaging it up with like more general data.
Absolutely. Excited for that to become a standard. And then talk to us a little bit about the utility around the Connects token, who's participating in governance, and is that another area that maybe the community could potentially get involved in?
Yes. So there's a few things there. So Next today is used for governance in the Connects DAO. The XCRC20 properties of it are particularly useful for this. So like today you can basically vote and or delegate from any chain. The DAO technically exists on Ethereum, but it's actually like an omni-chain DAO. The DAO interacts with contracts everywhere. I think we have the first fully working in production, like end-to-end cross-chain governance system. So like as a user, as a DAO, we're completely chain agnostic. There isn't really even any sense of being on a single chain, which is pretty awesome. Now, of course, like that's like one of the kind of key things that we wanted to launch as part of getting the token live. But the goal was always to work towards like Connects is an infrastructure protocol. And there's like with all infrastructure protocols, there's always like there's different kinds of needs for tokens throughout the stack. And so this is the case with like protocols like the Graph or even Ethereum itself, where, you know, the goal of the token, unlike in a DeFi protocol, the goal of the token usually ends up being to kind of like secure or fairly order or do other kinds of like basically like fair selection mechanisms within an infrastructure system. In Connects, there's a few things that have been hypothesized. Now, of course, it's really up to the DAO to kind of like move forward with deciding how to implement them and when to implement them. But a couple of things that have been talked about in the ecosystem are staking. So you know, we at the moment the process of running a router in Connects is somewhat permissioned. This is mostly to like reduce like MEV and other associated costs. But one of the ways to make it totally permissionless is to make it so that routers simply stake to join the system. And so you could have any number of routers just join the system by like buying Next tokens in the market and then staking them. And then in the process of doing that, you know, earn revenue throughout the network. The other place that we've kind of explored some people have suggested and we think is quite interesting is locking up Next to sort of signal where where routers should provide liquidity. So almost like a V token model. It's a little bit different than how some other V token models like Velodrome and things like that work, but the approach here would be a more kind of neutral way if you're a new token issuer and you want to make your token transferable across chains, or you're building some sort of like cross-chain application using Connects, say you're doing like cross-chain staking. To do that, you need a certain amount of routers to like hold liquidity in your asset. But routers upfront don't really know the kind of revenue that they're going to earn by doing that. Now, the way that you do this traditionally in DeFi is that you like in a DEX or something like that, you go and provide liquidity incentives. And then once you provide liquidity incentives, that creates some of the initial liquidity needed, people can start trading. And then eventually like the fees that are coming in from trading offsets the need for ongoing incentives forever. We think that there's kind of a need for something similar. At least people in the community have suggested that there is a need for something similar where you want to signal to routers up front that like there is an opportunity here for them to like supply liquidity in so and so asset or provide services for so and so type of use case. And so we're that's one that I think is quite interesting as well.
Amazing. And you mentioned the DAO. How big is the DAO today? And how can you get involved in that?
How big is the DAO today is a good question. I actually don't know exactly off the top of my head. I think last I checked, we had like 10,000 Next holders or something like that. I don't know how many of those are active. And of course, like it's always hard to tell from just looking at like on-chain stats. That said, I think there is a lot of activity happening in the DAO. We are very fortunate to have some incredibly amazing delegates as part of our ecosystem. So we have folks from like all sorts of incredible organizations. So we have folks from Safe, we have folks from Yearn, we have folks from the Graph Foundation. So Eva is a delegate. We have folks from a bunch of different chain ecosystems, Rollup as a service providers, infrastructure providers. We have routers from our own ecosystem. We have projects that are building on top of Connects. We have token issuers. And so I think we've been extremely fortunate to be working with like some incredible supporters of the ecosystem. And I think a lot of the activity that is happening right now is being like driven forward by them. Beyond that, how do you get involved? There's a couple of different ways. At this stage, we're still quite early, so there's definitely a lot of opportunities. And of course, there's also a lot of because we're early, it's also a time where it just requires a lot more initiative. So like if you're interested and if you have a good idea as to something that can really help the ecosystem, the best way to get involved is to jump into our Discord and start talking to people about it. And you would really have to be a leader on it. The next steps from there would be work to get broader support from like our community, work to get broader support from delegates, and push for like submitting an RFC into the DAO, into our DAO forum. So that's the forum is forum.connects.network, and then our Discord is discord.gg/connects.
Awesome. Thank you. And then you've been in this game for a long time, 6+ years. What surprised you the most?
That's a good question. I think one thing that surprised me a lot is just how quickly the space grew in 2020 to 2021. It felt like everybody kind of, had to take a break for COVID. And then when we came back, suddenly the whole space was like 10 to 20x larger. And like, we were so used to like interacting. I mean, I think before that in like the 2019 days, it was really 1,000 people that were like involved in things and you could really, you knew everybody. And then so to come back and notice that like, okay, everyone's organizations had grown so much and like now you were not just interacting with like the founders or individual people from organizations, but now there was also another like 50, 100 people in that org that like you didn't know. And I think some of the effects of that like growth have been really, really surprising to me. So like, the ways in which that has changed how we think about things like operationalize the space is really cool. It's kind of really awesome to see, and I've been really surprised to see the like level of like maturity and the like bar for execution has grown very significantly in the last couple of years. You used to be able to get away with just like writing some code, deploying it, and like telling a few people about it, and then it got traction. This was the story of Uniswap, for example, where like Uniswap ran with like a 7-person organization until like a couple of years ago, which is kind of crazy. And now, of course, that's not really possible anymore. Now you actually have a need to like build a larger organization or a larger set of sub-organizations that are sometimes hundreds of people in order to actually get things done. And then I think the other thing that's been kind of surprising is just how long it's actually taken for the infrastructure to get figured out. It's like the whole space has moved super fast, but at the same time, the infrastructure pieces, we're not that much further than we're further along than we were when I joined the space. But like in terms of our thinking, a lot of the same problems that existed then, the same conversations we were having then are the same problems that exist now. And so, it's infrastructure takes time. And that's been a big learning for me. It's like it really takes time to do right. And when you see infra projects just sort of like take off and go absolutely parabolic, it's either one of two things. Either they've been around for a very, very long time and there was a lot of like many, many years, sometimes half a decade of work that went into things before that happened, or they're sort of more fly by night and they're not going to last very long. That's like, it usually tends to be one or the other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think decentralization, it's not super sexy. It takes a long time and no one really talks about that. Like how much work you have to roll up your sleeves and get so much done. And it does take a long time to do it right and focus on censorship resistance and all the important principles that we live and die by. Amazing. And then yeah. I just want to talk a little bit about decentralization. Like, why are you passionate about decentralization? We touched a little bit on it earlier, but I want to give the opportunity to go deeper.
I mean, I think the majority of the problems that exist in the world today, sorry, just turning the light on. I think the majority of the problems that like some of the majority of the biggest problems that humanity is facing today seem to come from just like a lack of efficient or effective coordination around something. And I think like a big part of that comes from things being owned by like single large scale corporations or governments and really not having like a very like deep connection to like what individual people actually want. I really care about decentralization. I think it's really important because I think it provides the only counterbalance to the like accelerating pace of technology in the world that we live in today, where one of the really awesome, it's undoubtable that like we live in the best time for humanity ever so far, right? Like human beings are living way longer than they used to. Our quality of life is way better than it was. But at the same time, like there's also so many incredibly awful things happening. And I think a big part of the reason for that is that like the technology is there. The capacity to solve things like world hunger exists, but they're just not evenly distributed. And they're not evenly distributed because as the like the rate of technology innovation continues, the people who have power basically are able to continue investing into technology at a much faster rate than people who don't. And technology then tends to always like accumulate, like the benefits of it tend to accumulate in the hands of a relatively smaller part of the population. And so even though the world itself has gotten much better overall, like it's also gotten much more unequal. I think there was a statistic that I saw relatively recently, which said that like income inequality is actually roughly at the same place that it was during the French Revolution, which is kind of insane. This is really the time when they started cutting heads. So it's really bad. And I think the only way to solve this, especially as we start going towards smart AI, like as soon as we head towards things like AGI, I think a nightmare scenario would be if a single company or a single world government developed AGI and controlled it. That would be insane. It would probably be the end of human beings, because I can't see any outcome where that doesn't lead to like really, really widespread insane inequality or just all out global war. From my perspective, decentralization is how we stop that from happening. That is basically the check and balance that needs to exist around the growth of technology. This is like crypto is a political technology. It is fundamentally a technology that attempts to apply ethics. I say attempts to because like I know that there's also like all sorts of shady shit in this space as well. But it's our way to attempt to apply ethics and human morality and like benefit for the public good towards technological growth, which is usually not necessarily oriented around public good.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think we also just need an option away from this top-down, authoritarian, centralized world that's bottoms up and decentralized and self-sovereign and free. So I'm grateful to be on that journey alongside you. And the last question is just, how are you defiant?
Yeah, I think a bunch of things. There's two different ways, I would say. The first is Kinex has been around for a very long time. There are very few other organizations in the space that have been around for this long, and especially ones that have like been through as many just ridiculous things as we have. I think it's just this whole space is insane. I think one of the ways that I'm defiant is that I want to see this through. Like I'm not going to stop building Kinex. I don't think Kinex is going to stop existing. Like we are fundamentally a defiant protocol. We are going to be around we're going to be here in decades. Like we're not going anywhere. We will continue building. We'll be continuing to try to build for the benefit of the space, even if it isn't in the way that we expect. I think that this is fundamentally one of the staying power and the willingness to be sort of like to continue building for the long term instead of like cashing out and exiting, and as well as the like ability to be resilient over that long period of time is fundamentally defined. And then I think the second way is that I think we and I individually, I don't blame governments or companies or the status quo. I don't think it's really anybody's fault that we've ended up in this place. You know, it's just a system of broken incentives that we live in. And I'm defiant against that system of broken incentives. I think that we can beat it. I think that we human beings for thousands of years have struggled to effectively coordinate with each other. And I think that blockchains, and I think that this technology represents our first, the first ever mechanism where it's cheap enough for people to work together and build rules together that are like publicly enforced rather than individually enforced, that we can actually beat that problem. And I think that's incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah. One thing I've definitely learned is that if the incentive is there, people will do it and people will abuse power to create the incentive. So it's important to fight against that. Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on The Defiant. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.